You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, our guest says it's time for Republicans and Democrats to come together and make tough choices to avoid a debt-based calamity. We'll find out what he has in mind for the federal deficit. First, the historically diverse array of Democratic presidential candidates features a record 6 women in the race. Of those 6, Senators Kamala Harris of California and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts are making up ground in the polls and are considered serious contenders for the nomination at this point. Their popularity has brought back conversations about gender that played out during the 2016 presidential election, when Hillary Clinton became the first woman ever to be nominated for president on a major party ticket. Picking a nominee often requires Democrats to consider who has the best shot at beating President Trump. Some polls show a candidate's gender is something voters are taking into account. Erin Cassess is an associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. Her research focuses on the behavior of women as voters and as candidates. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk to us about what you're seeing so far early in this election when it comes to whether voters, especially Democratic primary voters, are ready to vote for women running for office.
Sure. So I think a lot of people are asking whether this question about electability is really about gender. It's really a question about, is the country ready for a woman president? Can a woman win the Midwest? And I think that in a lot of ways, this kind of concern conflates Clinton's loss with her gender. So it cast female candidates as risky choices. And while sexism definitely played a role in 2016, there were a lot of other factors. So Clinton's strategy in the Midwest and her small number of visits to Michigan and Wisconsin have been criticized, and nationwide, right? Black turnout was low. So whoever wins the nomination is going to be tuned to those problems and adjust their strategy accordingly.
Now, there's some interesting polling out there, and I think you've talked about this in the past, where when you ask voters, would you vote for a woman running for president? Most people say, yeah. But if you ask them if they think other people would vote for a woman running for president, a lot of people say no. What's up with that?
Well, I think there's debate over what that difference actually means. So some people think it's a way for people to express bias without having to go right out and say that they wouldn't vote for a female president. And other people think that it's reflecting something people are seeing in their social context. So they really are willing to vote for a female president, but they're getting some kind of vibe or hearing some kind of comments in their social circles that are making them doubt this. The way the polling question is worded actually makes me think of some of the polls that were conducted in 2016, where pollsters asked not about vote choice, but about who people think will win. And the idea was kind of the same, that maybe we're going to get this informal tally of social networks. And it turned out that the answers to those questions were not really predictive of the outcome of the presidential race, and that mostly what people were picking up on with those questions was how people were processing what they were seeing in the media. So, the disconnect between people saying they would vote for a woman and their neighbors not voting for a woman might be a reflection of this broader electability narrative and media stories about whether the country is ready for a female president.
Talking to Erin Cassess, associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. We're talking about women running for president, and we'll talk some about women voting for people running for president, whether candidates are held to different standards if they're men or women, by the media, by voters, by each other. And you can join in on the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a woman running on the Democratic side of things? Are you hoping to see a woman as president in 2020 or in this decade? What do you see as some of the challenges facing women running for office? If you're a woman who's run for office successfully or otherwise, local, statewide, or beyond, love to hear from you and your experiences, whether you think you were treated differently in any way as a candidate. Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Erin, this is kind of a unique situation on the Democratic primary, about 24 candidates, and it's hard to stand out for men or women. Do you see the women in this primary race in particular getting different kinds of questions in the media than the men in the field?
Well, I don't think that they're necessarily getting different kinds of questions. I think, you know, most of the candidates are really being questioned about their records and their qualifications. I think at this level, that makes sense, right? Research on down ballot races, like looking at congressional races, shows that female candidates sometimes have a greater scrutiny of their qualifications. So that's one way that gender bias can show up. So to give an example from the 2018 midterms, incumbent Republican Senator from Nevada, Dean Heller, released this campaign ad that suggested his opponent, Jackie Rosen, fabricated parts of her resume. Right? So Rosen ended up producing documentation to show that she really had those degrees and then went on to win the race. But I think it's just like a particularly salient example of questioning female candidates on their qualifications.
Do we associate different characteristics with men and different characteristics with women when they're running for office? Is there research on what kind of traits voters assign to men versus women?
Sure. So there's differences based on traits, and then there's also differences based on policy issues, like which policy issues they're going to be more or less competent on. And those tend to fall along kind of stereotypical gendered lines. So women are perceived as being more collaborative, warmer, more caring, you know, more constituent-oriented in that kind of empathic way, whereas male candidates have stereotypic associations that are more kind of agentic, right, or independent, aggressive, what we typically think of as stereotypes associated with leadership.
Do we know if there's a portion of the American electorate who will flat out not vote for a woman for an office like president?
There are, I guess, some things that we can look at to indicate how willing voters are. So some of the social science research tries to quantify voters' levels of sexism using surveys. And so one of the kinds of sexism that we look at is called hostile sexism. And this is really this kind of hostility toward upending traditional gender roles, right? Kind of wanting to maintain stereotypic paths for men and women and qualities for men and women. And people who score high on those survey measures show a lot of resistance to women's leadership. And it was associated with not turning out to vote, right, among Democratic men, and then also having a preference for Donald Trump among voters as a whole.
Is it, we hear a lot about partisan identity being really strong in the United States. Does it seem likely that sexism would be enough to get somebody to switch their vote from Democrat to Republican or vice versa?
It's pretty unlikely in this era of polarization. I think the concern might be that people would not turn out to vote. So it would depress turnout as opposed to causing a party switching. So just like, you know, women won't cross party lines to vote for other women, don't think that people who are high on hostile sexism would cross party lines to vote for a member of the opposing party.
Now, we've seen moments where women running for office will reference gender in response to criticisms from fellow candidates. I want to give a listen to Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
And I am the only candidate here who has passed a law protecting a woman's right of reproductive health and health insurance. And I'm the only candidate who has passed a public option. And I respect everybody's goals and plans here. But we do have one candidate that's actually advanced the ball. And we got to have access for everyone. I've done it as a public option.
Senator Klobuchar, I want to get you. I'm fascinated by this, Senator Klobuchar.
I just want to say there's three women up here that have fought pretty hard for a woman's right to choose. So I'll start with that.
Jay Inslee, Governor Jay Inslee, starting that off, and then Senator Klobuchar. What do you make of a moment like that?
Sure. I think that Klobuchar is kind of interjecting, using gender as a credential, saying, like, this is an area that we think of as a woman's issue. There are women up here who've made this a priority and who've taken a lot of legislative action on this. And I think that is a way that gender can be used kind of to advance and to kind of cement that policy objective. female candidates also do that sometimes with motherhood. So you'll hear the candidates talking about how their focus on childcare policy is motivated by their own experiences as mothers and struggling to pay the cost of childcare. So we see that all the female candidates have pretty well articulated positions on reproductive rights and also on childcare.
Talking to Erin Cusses, a professor of political science at the University of Delaware, looking at gender and the 2020 presidential election. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on how women are treated by the media, by voters, by other candidates when they run for office? Do you take gender into account when deciding whether or not to support a political candidate? How is this all playing into the 2020 presidential race, the Democratic primaries? Have you run for office if you're a woman? Love to hear your story. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with political science professor Erin Cusses from the University of Delaware, looking at how gender factors into the 2020 presidential election. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. A lot of women running on the Democratic side of things. Do you see them being treated differently in the media? Do you think women are held to different standards than men when they run for office? Do you have a question for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Gender and race do not qualify nor disqualify anybody. What matters is what they will do for us.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Erin, is that the norm? Is that how most people think, or at least say they think?
I think it depends. Some people feel that having a representative who shares a characteristic with them, like gender, like race, means that they have a set of common experiences to draw on, and that person is going to make policy from, you know, that place of experience. For other people, right, they're less interested in having a descriptive representative, and they're more focused on the specific messaging. So I think it kind of depends on what you're looking for in a candidate.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Ned joins us now in Eau Claire. Ned, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I would like to see Elizabeth Warren be our first woman president. I think it's high time we had a woman. Great Britain's had a woman. And I think that, you know, you just talked about messaging. I think she's right on with the messaging that we need for this country on race, the environment, the economy, education, all kinds of issues. And I would feel very confident voting for her. I think that she can debate well. She's articulate and she's smart. And I would love it if she was our first woman president.
Ned, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen some suggestions, Erin, that as a candidate, like in this case, Elizabeth Warren, when we see people just as generic candidates, we might see men and women differently. As we get more contact with them, see them talk more, hear their policies, we see them more as individual candidates and judge them more on that sort of thing. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Stereotypes matter most when we have the least information about the candidates. And because we're at such an early stage in the primary race, this might be, you know, a time when stereotypes are having their maximum effect. The good news is that people are increasingly paying attention to the campaign. I think Pew released some data today that said 63% of Americans are paying attention to the race already, and that's a record high. We had record viewership for the primary, or for the debates, rather. And so all of this is giving people more information to help them really start to see the candidates in an individualized way.
A question that comes up sometimes is likability for any candidate, men or women. Did I see something that said that being seen as disliked is worse for a woman running off for office than it is for a man? Say if you have two historically unpopular or disliked candidates like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, it might hurt the woman more than the man in that case?
Sure. So researchers call this the double bind. And the double bind is that women are evaluated in terms of their warmth and their competence. And they really have to hold on to both. Likeability, it kind of relates to this warmth dimension. If you go too far in one direction, like focusing too more on competence and qualifications, women risk being seen low on this warmth dimension as being unlikable. And if they're, you know, stressing these more warmer characteristics, they might be seen as likable but less competent. So the double bind is how to navigate those expectations that candidates be seen as both warm and competent.
Talking to Erin Cassess from the University of Delaware, looking at women running for office in 2020 and beyond. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Erin, do we know if there's a partisan split on how people perceive women running for office? Do things work differently for Republicans and Democrats?
There is a split, and there's more demand for descriptive representation, for women's representation on the Democratic side of the aisle. So if you ask Democrats and Republicans, you know, how important is it to have a woman represent you, the percentages are much higher on the Democratic side and only about 20% on the Republican side. So it's just not as much of a priority for Republican women compared to Democratic women.
Now, let's turn to voters for a moment. I know it's impossible to say that there's such a thing as that all women vote in a particular way. There's a lot of diversity in women, of course. But are there calculated appeals from either party to try to get women on their side? And how do those play out?
Well, I think you're right that there is a lot of diversity among women. Women are prioritizing different issues. So I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren has this child care cost calculator that's kind of translating what her policy initiatives would mean in terms of concrete dollars in your pocket. But something like that isn't just going to apply to female candidates or to female voters, rather. And those kinds of numbers are of interest to both male and female voters, I think.
Let's bring in another caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. A lot of the discussion with the squad of Congresswomen, you notice that at Trump rallies, even going back as far as 2016, the only chanting they did for lock her up or send her home or any of that are for women. They don't do that for men. They've never done that for Pete Buttigieg or for Bernie Sanders or anybody. It's underlying misogyny is even worse than the underlying race question.
Tom, thanks for the call. Erin, what do you think?
And it's hard to say, you know, if it's race or if it's gender. I think both of these are at play here. But the chants are definitely revealing a kind of punitive attitude towards women. So lock her up is like punishing Clinton for her perceived transgressions. Sending them home, you know, is making people leave the country on the basis of, you know, who they are and what they've said in the past. So I think that the thing to focus on is that there's kind of a punitive orientation behind it. And then the debate that people are having now is this dangerous, right? Is this language inciting people to violence? Is it kind of a dog whistle?
Tom, thanks for the call. We saw in the 2018 midterms, Erin, I think records for both how many women ran for Congress and how many women won. Do you see it as an indicator of a long-term change?
I think we did see a lot of historic firsts in 2018, and that might be the trajectory of the party right now. First, in terms of racial and ethnic diversity of candidates, sexual orientation, and religiosity, all of these different factors. So I think there's a lot of room for expanding how we think about leadership and who's going to be a viable candidate in 2020.
Do voters look at women differently if they're running for legislative office, Congress or state legislature, say, versus executive office, a president, a governor, a mayor?
Definitely. Our expectations for members of deliberative bodies are very different than for executive positions. The kind of masculine associations with executive positions are much more magnified. Meredith Conroy wrote this book called Masculinity, the Media, and American Presidency. And she argues that the presidential races are always about masculinity, even when men run against each other. Right? So it's kind of a contest, kind of the way Biden challenged Trump to a push-up contest the other day on Morning Joe. So women, when they're running in the presidential race, have to overcome this mismatch between stereotypes of the office and stereotypes we have about women leaders.
Also, over the last few years, we've seen a lot of things that put issues of gender in the forefront of political conversations, accusations of sexual assault by the president, more recent ones as well, the nomination and confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, moves to overturn Roe versus Wade. these issues being put into the spotlight, does that change things when it comes to gender and women running for office?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that some of the candidates have been more explicit with their connection to the Me Too movement than others. For Kirsten Gillibrand, some of the criticisms that she's been getting are that she was maybe, too aggressive in pursuing Franken's ouster, and that it represents the overreach of the Me Too movement. So I think candidates are forced to engage in their past record on these issues and also to answer questions on them because they continue to be a salient and at the forefront of the minds of voters.
Well, in about 2 years, Aaron, you and your colleagues in political science are going to have a lot of data to work with from the 2020 mm-hmm. elections. What kind of things, what kind of trends are you going to be watching for?
I'm looking at the way that hostile sexism impacts how people are paying attention to campaigns, how they're engaging with campaigns, and affecting election outcomes. And I think sexism is an important bias to understand in the country, but it's not necessarily the case that the existence of this bias should really drive our political strategies. So I'm trying to understand how it operates in these election contexts at different levels of office.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Aaron Cassess is an associate professor of political science at the University of Delaware. She joined us today to talk about gender and the 2020 presidential elections. Now, the White House said this week that the federal deficit is forecast to reach $1 trillion this year. That would be the first time it's hit that mark since the four-year span following the Great Recession. Before that, it had never happened. Meanwhile, the national debt is more than $22.5 trillion and climbing. As a candidate, President Trump promised to eliminate it. Instead, it's gone up $2.6 trillion since he took office. He also vowed to wipe out the annual deficit. Our guest says it's time for a grand deal on deficits. Both parties should play together to do it, and that there's no room for sacred cows. Brian Riedel is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a member of their Economics 21 division, where he specializes in budget, tax, and economic policy. He's a native of Appleton, by the way. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
How worried are you, and how worried do you think we should all be about the overall federal debt and this annual deficit?
We should be very worried. It doesn't seem like it's mattering now. Interest rates are low, the economy is growing, but we're hitting such an avalanche of debt that at some point it's going to hit us hard, and at that point the pain's going to be much worse. You know, right now the deficit is just about to hit $1 trillion. And within the next decade, if we just keep current policies, it's going to go to $2 trillion. And if interest rates rise, it could approach $3 trillion. Over the next 30 years, the rosy scenario from the Congressional Budget Office is an $84 trillion deluge of new debt. At a certain point, financial markets are going to react. Interest rates are going to rise. The interest cost is going to force up huge tax hikes. And the problem is, we've seen from other countries, by the time you get to that point, it's too late to do the reforms. It becomes very difficult to consolidate at that point. The spending cuts and the tax increases would be like nothing we've ever experienced before. So my preference, the wise course of action, is to start now and start gradually phasing in some more modest reforms rather than wait for events to force more drastic changes.
Let's key in on this annual deficit for a minute. That's the shortfall for the year. $1 trillion, what I know has some people worried is, okay, the idea is when the economy's bad, it's okay to run a bigger deficit. The economy's pretty good right now, and people are wondering, so why, in the midst of a good economy, is the deficit going up?
The deficit's going up for a couple reasons. About half of the budget deficit is attributable to a combination of the 2017 tax cuts, as well as the 2018 budget deal that increased discretionary spending. The Republicans and Democrats came together on that grand plan. So half is you split up half of it between recent legislation, the tax cuts, and the big increase in discretionary spending that both parties agreed to. And the other half, that's actually the bigger long-term problem, is the shortfall in Social Security and Medicare. Social Security and Medicare this year are going to run a combined cash shortfall of about $450 billion, and it's rising rapidly. And the scary thing going forward is the cost of the tax cuts and the discretionary spending deal are going to stay at about $450 billion a year. That's not going to rise. That's going to stay about the same. The reason the deficit is going to keep rising is because the Social Security and Medicare shortfall in the next decade is going to go from $450 billion to $1.7 trillion. Basically, that $1.3 trillion increase in the Social Security and Medicare shortfall is what's going to get us from $1 trillion to $2 trillion. But to try to make a long answer short, everybody's to blame for the mess we're in.
White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow says, don't worry about it too much. Here's what he said at a CNBC event last week.
There are basically only two ways to lower budget deficits. One is economic growth, which is worth the $3.5 trillion per point of GDP. That's why I'm harping on USMCA. It's not small potatoes. And limited government. And we are pursuing both. I don't see this as a huge problem right now at all. Quite manageable.
So we're going to grow our way, in effect, out of the deficit. What do you say to that, Brian?
You know, Larry's a friend of mine, but I could not disagree more with him on this. He's correct that if you could increase economic growth by one percentage point, say from 2% a year to 3% per year, that would take care of about $3 trillion over 10 years. The problem is the baseline is about $13 trillion in deficits, so you're only getting rid of a quarter of it. The bigger problem is increasing economic growth permanently by an entire percentage point is extraordinarily difficult. It's difficult in part because the workforce has pretty much stopped growing now that the baby boomers are retiring. And because the workforce isn't growing very fast, more of the growth has to come from productivity. And getting an entire percentage point increase in productivity would be almost unprecedented in the past 40 years. So economic growth is very important, and if we could gain a percentage point out of it, that would be great. But we're not going to grow our way out of the deficits. It's just not, the math isn't there.
Brian Riedel is with us from the Manhattan Institute. We're looking at the federal deficit, $1 trillion this year, the growing federal debt as well. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your solutions, if any, at 800-642-1234. Brian, before we get to the kinds of changes you would like to see in the federal budget, let's get into the politics. The notion of Democrats and Republicans working together on this seems unlikely, but you point towards some historical examples that could be inspirations.
Yeah, you know, we've had grand deals before. In 1983, Social Security was going bankrupt, and Republicans and Democrats came together in order to finish a grand deal. What was important about then was you actually had a program going bankrupt within weeks. That brought everyone to the table. And in fact, a lot of the budget deals we've had have been triggered by an event. Like the 2011 discretionary spending caps was the result of us hitting the debt limit. There was a panic about hitting the debt limit. What we need sometimes is a short-term trigger that motivates everybody, that grasps people's attention, and that makes it worth doing something. The other thing we need historically that we've really lost is a Congress that can actually work together from both sides of the aisle. When I researched the 14 main deficit negotiations over the past 40 years, what struck me is how in the 80s and 90s, even parties that were very partisan were still able to work together in good faith when they wanted to. Over the past 20 years, I couldn't find a single case study of a deficit reduction deal where I consider the negotiations to be in good faith. And that worries me the most. You can always have events bring people to focus on the deficit, but if the parties aren't even on speaking terms, the negotiations are going to be a mess.
Let's turn to that first part first, the idea that, okay, there's some looming disaster. Nobody's going to let this thing happen. It used to be we thought nobody would let a government shutdown happen. That's for sure going to motivate action. Is that still true?
You make a great point. We used to have these penalties where if there isn't a budget deal, the government shuts down, so everyone comes to the table. Well, we've had multiple shutdowns in the past few years inaugurated by both parties. It used to be the debt limit would motivate everyone to come to the table. Well, now they just suspend the debt limit. It used to be that you would have these automatic spending cuts called sequestration, and Congress would come to the table to negotiate a deal. Well, instead, they just cancel the sequestration. And so there's really no looming crisis that brings everybody to the table. But the lack of a looming crisis doesn't mean there's no danger. It means that the danger is lying in wait, and that in 5-6 years it's going to be the economy going under, and we'll have wished that we had something in the meantime that had triggered us and brought us to the table. But we need new default policies, new triggers, new events that motivate people to do the right thing.
And then when it comes to negotiating in good faith on the other side, it seems like there's a lot of built-in penalties, political penalties for doing that. Either some change you might make might give the other side ammunition against you in an election, or if you negotiate too much, there's a serious risk of a primary challenge from within your own party.
Yeah, the base is controlling both parties right now on this issue. Republicans have this view of, you know, we can solve the deficit by cutting waste, fraud, and abuse and welfare, and there's no reason to give an inch or negotiate with the other side. Of course, you could eliminate all waste, fraud, and abuse and welfare programs tomorrow. You wouldn't come close to balancing the budget. The narrative on the far left is that if you just raise taxes on the rich and cut defense, you can balance the budget, and so there's no need to negotiate with conservatives on anything else. Yet, I've run the numbers, you could eliminate the Defense Department and set 100% tax rates on the rich, and it wouldn't be enough. The problem, of course, though, is the politics just don't bring people together. And even when members of Congress sit down, instead of kind of doing good faith negotiations where they sit down together and go, okay, how can we get to yes? What do you need and what do I need? Instead, the way they negotiate is mostly through threats, through intimidation, through attempts to use reporters and the media against each other. It's extraordinarily ugly. And again, members have to learn how to negotiate with people that you don't necessarily like.
Brian Riedel is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, member of their Economics 21 division, talking about the growing national debt and the annual budget deficit that the White House says will reach $1 trillion this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the debt and deficit? Do you think about the debt and deficit? Is this something you think we should be worried about? What would you like to see happen to chip away at the debt? What would it take to get, as our guest says, both parties negotiating in good faith? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the rising national debt and the growing annual budget deficit. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and solutions. Our guest is Brian Riedel, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We'll go to your calls now. Karen is with us in Cambridge. Karen, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. My question is about the Social Security Trust Fund. I didn't think that was part of the federal deficit. And so could you please clarify that? And since you're doing a lot of math, if we raise the limit on Social Security contributions, how would that look for refunding the Social Security Trust?
Karen, thanks for the call. Brian? Brian, are you there? Oh, looks like we've lost. Brian dropped off the line there. We'll reconnect with him as we talk here. Brian Riedel from the Manhattan Institute, member of their Economics 21 division. He specializes in budget, tax, and economic policy. We are talking about the federal debt and deficit. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll take some of your calls and comments while we're trying to connect to Brian Riedel right now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi. The question that lady just asked is a great one, because I don't know of any, even a penny that's part of the total deficit. But my comment and question is, the war debt, not a penny of that has been paid for, nor has there ever been a war tax or defense tax to pay for defense or the wars in the Middle East. And that's at least since the last 18 years, half of the debt, half of the national debt, over $10 trillion. And that's something that I never hear individuals like this address that. So that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234, taking your comments on the federal deficit and the annual debt. We've been hearing from people on Facebook. Joel says the perceived role of the government has grown far too large, in my humble opinion. Furthermore, states are required to operate under a balanced budget. Why should the federal government be any different? Michael writes, we'll never have a balanced budget. It's really nothing to worry about. We'll go now to Jim on the line in Lake Geneva. Jim, hi.
Hi. I really have to recommend you guys for finally putting on a program that interests me. We've been spending way too much time wasting energy and our voices talking about things of minor consequence when we have things like the national debt that is getting worse, as we have been hearing, and I suspected it. Haven't ever been able to find the numbers on. So we need to get taxes in line, and I think a lot of that is increasing cost to government, and then that all contributes to the debt. So please, NPR and have other people on to talk about the debt more often, because it is very important to all of us and all of our children.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling in. Brian Riedel is back with us now. Brian, I want to, one of the callers you missed there said, hey, isn't Social Security a trust fund? Isn't it separate? Isn't it isolated from this whole deficit argument?
Well, in theory it is, but in reality, Social Security is running a $100 billion deficit this year, and the deficit's going to rise to about $200 billion over the next 10 years. You see, the surpluses that were raised in the past got spent in the past. And so this, what they're doing now is they're drawing down the trust fund. But the trust fund is not actually a pile of money. It's just new. It's just a claim on new taxes. So basically, it's a shell game. Social Security is contributing to the budget deficit. It's about $100 billion this year. It'll rise to about $200 billion in the next decade.
And our caller had also asked about the caps on Social Security collections, tweaking those. What kind of changes could we see in Social Security itself that you think might be politically possible and effective?
Social Security is actually pretty easy to solve because there aren't that many options. You can raise the eligibility age. You can cut benefits for the wealthiest individuals, or you can raise the tax. One of the ideas that's out there is to raise the cap on Social Security taxes. That's about $135,000 right now, and to have people pay taxes all the way up. That would solve about 40% of the long-term shortfall. You'd still have to trim benefits. You still have to raise the eligibility age. One of the challenges, though, is that raising the cap is such a big tax increase on the wealthy that it would push combined state, federal, and FICA tax rates to about 60%, which some people may say, well, that's great, and that may be fine, but it doesn't leave a lot of room to raise taxes to fix Medicare, which is an even bigger problem. And there's only so much you can raise taxes on the rich before the rates get too high. And so Social Security it's easy to solve in a vacuum, but it gets really hard when you're trying to solve it with Medicare, too.
We also heard from Michael, who brought up the U.S. Military role in the Middle East since 2001 and in Afghanistan, for that matter. He says, hey, a lot of money, trillions in effect spent there, no extra tax collections to pay for that. How big a factor is that in the deficit?
In the past, it was a decent but not huge. Give me some numbers. Under President Kennedy, defense was half of the budget. But before 2001, before 9/11, it fell all the way down to 16% of the budget. The effect of the wars in Afghanistan pushed it back from 16 to 20%, and it has actually since fallen back down to about 15% of the budget. So as a percent of all federal spending, defense is actually a little bit lower today than it was before 9/11. It's about 15% of the budget. You know, certainly people are free to advocate additional cuts in defense. you know, but it has actually dropped as a percentage of the budget. It's not enough to fix the problem, but, you know, people are certainly free to advocate, you know, realistic reductions.
Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Aaron on the line in Oregon. Aaron, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. Great segment. Brian, I'm a father of a 4 and a 6-year-old, and this is an issue that really scares the heck out of me because I try to think about where their world is going to be in 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, we've talked a lot about what isn't being done, what needs to be done. But if past is prologue, nothing's going to get done. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind reading some tea leaves for me and telling me what you think you know, our world's going to look like in 10, 15, 20 years.
Well, first, my girls are 4 and 7, so I'm in the same boat you are. You know, I think ultimately the deficit is going to get bigger, and at a certain point, there will be a response in the federal budget. Interest rates are going to start to go up, which is going to cost more to buy a home, buy a car, and taxes are going to go up because the interest cost of the budget is going to be worse. So my prediction of what we're probably going to have to get used to when our kids are older is a more slow economy because of the size of the debt and its impact on interest rates and growth. I think it's probably going to hurt the economy. Additionally, I would expect significant tax increases eventually, just because I don't anticipate right now that there's ever going to be the will to make the difficult choices on spending, because you have a lot of programs like Social Security and Medicare that are very tough to reform, and programs like defense can't get you all the way there. You know, Europe has value-added taxes or national sales taxes of about 20 or 25%. We may end up heading in that direction, you know, because our spending levels are going to approach Europe. So, you know, I would expect, if we don't fix this, a slower economy and a lot higher taxes.
And very briefly, Brian, do you hear anybody in places where they can make a difference talking about this lately?
I live in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of talk about it behind the scenes, but there's also a viewpoint that if you talk about it publicly, you're going to get beat up because you start having to describe tax increases and spending cuts to popular programs. So the politicians that I talk to that I used to work for say, well, the public doesn't care, so why should I?
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brian Riedel is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a member of their Economics 21 division. He's an Appleton native. We talked with him about the rising national debt, which surpassed $22 trillion earlier this year, and the annual deficit this year hitting $1 trillion. If you've got anything else to join in with about that, you can still post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein faces a new round of charges of sexual trafficking of minors after a chilling expose of his past crimes and what many say was a soft punishment. We'll get the latest in that story. Democrats in the U.S. House pushed for a minimum wage increase. Our guest gives us the details. You can join in with your thoughts. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. This week, let's make ramen. Our guest says the Asian noodles are a flexible ingredient that we can have a lot of fun with. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.